Oh, okay. Man, I was going to call the show Much Fado About Nothing.
I'll put this bit in the intro so you can actually do that.
I'm calling it that. I'm writing it in the show notes.
Welcome to episode 27 of Bad Voltage. My apologies on behalf of the team that we're a day late pushing this out. We had a few unknowing circumstances kick off, and we're a little bit late getting out there, but here we are. Mr. Garcia, what are we going to talk about?
So one of the things we're going to talk about is an extra meaty, extra lengthy news section with a little bit of a kicker at the end.
And we're going to talk about money. In the last show, we asked the question, should the Linux desktop move to a paid app ecosystem? Would that be better or not? And we're actually going to go into it in alarming detail in places.
And now, Bad Voltage.
You know what?
What?
Yeah, you do. You know what? You know exactly what. It's time for some news.
It is time for some news.
It is. It's been a pretty newsy time. Do one of you guys want to get going, or do you want me to? What do you want to do?
I'll kick it off if you want. Or X chomping at the bit. Go ahead. Do you look excited?
Some chomping going. There's multiple chomping going on here.
I just thought this was interesting. There's a shop here in the UK called Maplin, and
the electronic parts place.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure about this, but I think the closest US equivalent would be Radio Shack.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right. And they've been in a major decline for years, and they're now at crunch time, and they're looking to sell the business and so on. The reason I thought this was interesting, and I believe Radio Shack in the US is undergoing the same thing, is it used to be a complete haven for people like us. You go there, they'll sell you electronic parts, they'd have all sorts of little things you could buy and interesting stuff and everything. But now, in a world with Amazon in it, are they just doomed to failure, places like this? Is there any reason for them to exist? Should we be sad that they've gone away, or what?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how they're doing, but I am sure how Radio Shack is doing, and it's poor. I read an interesting article a little while ago that the death in brick and mortar is as much to do with private equity as it is to do with online shopping, and that a lot of these stores, and Radio Shack is an example of one, got bought by private equity, loaded with debt, and then spent off in a way that was almost impossible to succeed. So it isn't, obviously online shopping is impacting brick and mortar stores, but not maybe to the degree that we believe it is. It's more how they're being funded now.
Hang on. So Maplin's temple of my childhood has perhaps not been destroyed by, you know, a perfectly sensible move of consumers to online shopping. It's been destroyed as some kind of massive tax dodge.
I mean, I wouldn't consider what private equity does a tax dodge.
It's a massive tax dodge. Yeah.
I'm also not. All right, Bernie. I mean, this may not be happening to them. I think, obviously, a place like that's going to be impacted more because the overlap of people interested in shopping online and people interested in shopping in that kind of store, obviously very high, right?
Yeah.
So I think unless they're doing something really compelling to get people into the stores, 2018 is going to be a challenging time period for them because so much is available online. And I mean, the one thing that stores like that, at least around here, used to kind of attract is I need something right now. And with Amazon now, even that's going away. So it's definitely challenging times, I would agree.
Well, I think another thing here was it reminds me with, you know, as we descend into old fogey territory, it reminds me of, you know, when I was a kid and you'd have stores like Maplin or Radio Shack in the US and you'd have record stores and music shops. And part of it was going in and speaking to someone knowledgeable about a topic, whether it's music or electronics or whatever, and then pointing you in the right direction. And with the internet, so much of that is irrelevant now. Because like if I go to one of these stores, the person there typically is a bit of a muppet and doesn't really know what they're talking about compared to the internet, right? It's like going to Guitar Center. There's way more knowledge online than any clerk at Guitar Center. So I think that's part of it. Although I have a question for both of you guys. Have either of you been into one of these new Amazon brick and mortar stores?
I haven't.
I haven't because there isn't one here. I'm not sure there's one in the UK at all, is there? There certainly isn't one in Birmingham.
Maybe not. I don't know. But they set one up in our town, and I was curious to see what it was like. And it's called an Amazon bookstore. But what's interesting is, they carry way more stuff than books. They have all kinds of different things.
Hang on. I thought they were called Amazon Go, and they were for groceries.
That's different.
Oh, right. So what are you talking about then?
He's not talking about that automated store where you don't have to check out because it just knows everything. He's talking about they're competing with like Barnes & Noble, kind of.
Yeah. So Amazon have set up these stores which have got mainly books, but they also sell their devices, but they also sell other stuff. Like, they sell smart home stuff. They have like gifts. They have a little Pete's coffee shop in there.
It's Waterstones.
It's basically Waterstones.
Barnes and Noble in the US. Right. Yeah. Okay.
But, what's interesting is, first of all, where we are, that store is absolutely thriving. Every time I've been in there, it's packed. And I think part of the reason for that is that I love the fact that I can go in there and browse, which is more fun in real life than it is online. And all of the products in there are the best rated products on Amazon. So like,
interesting. You know, that's how they decide what to stock.
Yeah. Huh. Well, from what I can tell, and it shows like little product reviews and this, that, and the other. So what's interesting is I went in there the other day to go and buy some books for Jack, cause he's, you know, as he learns to read, and the books in there were the highest rated books on Amazon. So you already know that everything in there is pretty decent. Cause I generally, as far as I'm concerned, Amazon reviews generally serve me pretty good. I've never bought anything that's had 4.5 stars and it's been a turkey. So I wonder what I'm interested to see how this hybrid of like the online and the in-person, like the brick and mortar world is going to work out.
I'm curious how that'll work out. I also think Amazon reviews are being gamed more and more, and I find myself trusting them less and less. A couple years ago, I would have absolutely agreed with you. Lately, there's so clearly some that are gamed that it's surprising.
It's interesting
Amazon's
you say
not
that.
Paying more attention.
And
to
they're
that.
Very polarized as well.
You
see an awful lot of, I thought this was okay. 5 stars. I thought this was slightly bad. 1 star.
Which, if that's people, right? But it's interesting you say that, Jeremy, because we buy almost everything off Amazon.
Yep.
And I would actually say, in my experience, it's got better.
Interesting.
So something's, interesting.
This sounds like a segment, because I mean, from a human psychology perspective, what Ak said makes sense, because you never really think to yourself, wow, this was a kind of decent product that doesn't make me happy or mad. I'm going to go rate that. That just isn't a...
Yeah. No, exactly. You only rate things if you've got strong feelings. But most things that most people buy most of the time are kind of meh. They're all right, or they're a bit less than all right. But hardly anything should be 1 or 5 stars, because hardly anything you interact with is 1 or 5 stars. But that's all you ever review. We talked about this about apps in the last show. On the bookstore note, I didn't know about this. I like bookstores, right? And the good one here in town, we've got 4 or 5 here in the city, obviously. But the one I like most is Waterstones. And to be clear here, Waterstones are not some kind of, mum and dad choir operation with a few dusty books. They're a huge multinational conglomerate. But nonetheless, Amazon opening up bookstores, if you say to people, why are monopolies a bad idea? Or why is price dumping a bad idea? It's because you sell things at below cost, drive all your competition out of business, and then steal the whole market. And as far as I can tell, Amazon, selling books cheaper than everyone else, bookshops going out of business because they can't compete with Amazon, and then Amazon opening up bookshops is the dictionary definition of that happening, isn't it?
I would say...
Yes.
First of all, again, this is definitely a segment. I'd say yes and no. I think, to be fair to Amazon, the reason why they're winning is because they've been innovative, and they started from a position of absolutely.
I would ask a publisher that question, but yeah,
I don't think it's in my mind, it's undeniable that Amazon have innovated in many different areas.
I'm not saying they're all bad, but equally their practices are.
But I think increasingly they're a logistics company that just wants to take a cut of every sale of anything digital or physical on Earth. I don't think they care about books anymore at all. I mean, they started with mostly books and they probably always have a soft spot. But I think if you look at what AWS is doing, what they're doing with competing with FedEx, I think they want a little tiny slice of every transaction.
I agree. I completely agree. So I think that their success is... I don't think their success is Bilderberg, people dressing as pheasants and, you know, running the world type shit. I think a chunk of it is just, frankly, they've outplayed the competition. And part of the reason for that is they started out, you know, they were, their unique thing was, of course, selling books online. And they've dominated the digital world, where Waterstones have taken a while to catch up. So anyway,
oh yeah, yeah.
I would like to point out that the first news item took 9 minutes.
Yes. Yes, we should probably move on. Jeremy, go on, give us some sugar.
Since I'm sure we won't get him through them all here, I'll pick a technical one. Did you see that Oracle decided to, after much gnashing of teeth, open source dtrace under the GPL in a way that would allow it to be included in Linux?
I did, actually.
And I did not.
And what do you think?
To be honest with you, I'd forgotten. When dtrace first came about, it seemed like it was going to be this incredibly powerful, brilliant tool, and then it was like, no, it's only available on Solaris, and everyone went kind of, whatever. Everyone in my orbit went, okay, whatever. And then I believe it's available on OSX. And then there was another little flare up of, oh, dtrace, it's amazing, look at all this cool stuff you can do, and everyone in my orbit went, whatever. So perhaps there'll be that again now, but because I could never have it, I never really got to grips with all the cool stuff it can do beyond hearing people I respect say, look at all the cool stuff this can do.
So it's interesting to me because we have on the Linux side taken a packet filter and made it what dtrace was. So eBPF now is probably more powerful on the back end. I think what's interesting to me would be taking the very well laid out front end of dtrace and making eBPF the back end of it, I think is probably more likely what's going to happen on Linux. It seems to me, I'm curious who inside Oracle championed this, because it's unlike most of the things Oracle does as far as stewarding open source. Super late to the game, obviously, but...
Yeah, it's a very un-oracular thing to do.
Oracular. If I was to hazard a guess, it's because a big deal required it, that they couldn't sign a particular deal unless this happened.
That's not an unreasonable view, given the Oracle.
Yeah, I think cynical, but
I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you.
I think big changes in companies are almost always tied to some kind of financial. So
it's either
outcome.
An internal champion usually who finally got their way, or sales. Yes, that's right. Been my experience as well.
And I would definitely anchor towards the sales side of things, particularly with Oracle. Yes. I would say.
So what do you have in the hopper?
Something that I think is kind of interesting, but you guys might not think is particularly interesting, and it relates to Snapchat. I'm trying to find it. Where did I put it? It's in here somewhere. Where did I put it? Did it get deleted?
They updated the UI.
Yes. So Snapchat updated their UI in their app. I don't use Snapchat because I'm not 15 years old. Bring the hate, people.
You sound like such an old fogey, honestly. Things we're talking about this time, how Snapchat is terrible, Maplin's shutting down, dtrace, which is 15 years old.
Seriously, it's like that, you know, that movie Last Vegas.
I imagine you used it once. You posted a picture of your lawn and the entire caption was, get off it.
I might actually do that.
Next on Bad Voltage, Super Mario Brothers 2 and what we thought.
So Snapchat updated their user interface in their app. It turned out that the people were not particularly happy about that. So someone filed a change.org petition. I tend to mainly think of change.org for, you know, changing the world, social activism type stuff. And it got 1.2 million signers as of this recording, to the point where Snapchat basically responded and were like, it's going to get better, honest. I'm paraphrasing. Now, 1.2 million sounds like a lot, but from what I can tell from the limited research that I've done, Snapchat have got 150 million users. So it's a pretty small proportion of their user base.
1% of their user base specifically went to a third-party external site and signed up to complain about a thing. That's loads.
It is. Well, that's the thing. Like, 1% of any user base actively... Well, put it this way. In social media context, a 1% conversion rate for someone to click on something is considered really good.
Yeah.
So for someone to do this in this context is notable. But I just thought it was interesting about change. Two things are interesting to me about this. One is change.org used as a feedback mechanism for companies, for projects. I haven't really seen this as much. I think this has happened. But the other thing is, and this is the wider thing, and this again could be a segment, is the balance between the crowd having an opinion and the crowd necessarily being right about that opinion. Now, I don't know if this change is any good or not. It may be genuinely terrible and everyone's right about this, but arguably you could have 1.2 million wrong people signing on to this, and it creates such a notable PR incident that, you know, that could be a bit unfair towards the organization or the cause or whatever it is in question. What do you guys think?
People are famously averse to UI change.
Yes.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
I'm not a Snapchat user because it's my daughter's thing rather than mine. But I'm not disagreeing with your point about being 15. I'm just saying.
Your daughter's a little older than 15. Actually, how old is she?
She's nearly 18.
She's 16, right?
She's nearly 18 now, yeah.
She will always be 7 to me. Your daughter will never ever be stop being a tiny little person who I met years ago.
Now,
it's very uncomfortable that she's becoming an adult.
Now think how it feels for me. But
seriously.
But I think, as Jeremy says, people are massively resistant to UI changes. I'm reasonably confident that when Twitter changed how favourites worked, you could have got a million signatures saying this is terrible. You certainly got a million tweets about it.
Right.
So yeah. I think it's slightly weird because this is like what user voice or whatever are for, right?
Yeah.
And so they went to change.org instead. I mean, to be clear, if you went to Snapchat with 1.2 million signatures, any way that you got them, they'd listen. Right. If you got 1.2 million people to sign a brick and then chucked it through their window, they'd pay attention.
I don't know if that's necessarily true.
And I don't think there are that many.
Maybe.
I'm not sure there are that many places out there which can handle a million different people signing up to a thing. Change.org can, because it's what they're built for.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting to me. I don't know why it's interesting to me, but I just thought it was a fascinating thing. Snapchat gave such a, and I don't blame them for this, because what can you do? But they gave such a classic, like, okay, we got it, kind of response.
We will take our users' concerns on board and look to improve this in the future, kind of thing. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, but they can either go, we're not changing it, you people are wrong, get stuffed, at which point you get another signature with 1.4 million signers on it.
Or they could say, yeah, it's bollocks, and that's probably not going to happen.
Which is probably not going to happen, especially since that sets the precedent that if enough people whine, they'll give up on changes. Now, it works for some things, take Patreon as an example. But that's because Patreon did a thing which everyone hated because it was wrong, not just because it was different.
Yeah. Yeah. The one thing I wrestle with...
Is this going to sod up the change.org people a bit? Because now everyone's going to think, hey, every time I've got a problem with the order of the buttons in Microsoft Word, I'll start a change.org petition. It's going to rather swamp their, you know, let's say Antarctica kind of vibe.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, as well, is the one thing I feel, and I appreciate this is complete, like, this is not a fixable thing, but something to me is uncomfortable about... you know, like, you can look at this from one of two angles. One is, brilliant, you know, this is change.org has provided a mechanism in which Snapchat users can express together their view that they're unhappy about something, and then that they can get through to the organization in the same way that Twitter has provided a way in which people can connect with their favorite celebrities and whatever else, right? The other way you could look at it is it's kind of mob mentality. Mm-hmm. And I think mob mentality for the right things is pretty cool, but mob mentality for the wrong things can be pretty dangerous. But I, there's nothing you can do about it, right? I mean, I don't,
you certainly can't have a policy which is mobs are okay when they're doing things I agree with.
Yeah, it's not going to really work very well. But yeah, there's just something that makes me feel a bit uncomfortable about that. But
I can't wait for your next book, yeah. The Wisdom of Crowds versus the Tragedy of the Commons.
Oh, God. Sounds like a lot of work.
I like that plan. Jezza!
What's next?
Oh, let's see. This one I thought was interesting because I hadn't heard anything about it, generally speaking, until I started doing research for some news items for this. And it's... Do you guys use Google Images?
All the time.
Yes. So did I. And yeah. I didn't actually notice this. So they removed the View Image button due to a lawsuit from Getty. So it says, this week, Google Image Search is getting a lot less useful with the removal of the View Image button. Before, users could search for an image and click the View Image button to download it directly without leaving Google or visiting the website. Now Google Images is removing that button, hoping to encourage users to click through to the hosting website if they want to download the image. And it was due to a lawsuit from Getty. It was so, A, I'm surprised I didn't notice this because I do use it, and... I'm surprised
there's been pressure for years and years and years from photographers and people like that who don't want people to be able to just easily grab an image without even bothering to think about, is this licensed, am I allowed to use it, and so on and so forth. And they do have a point. Equally, when Google removed this, it took approximately 5 seconds for someone to write a Chrome extension, which adds it back again.
But, I mean, most people realistically won't choose that. I was curious on both of your opinions on, is this Google doing something bowing to a potential advertiser slash whatever large company? Or is this something that, you know what, if I took an image, they should have to come. If they want to download it, that's one thing, but they should at least have to see where the image came from.
It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest. I think so many people, myself included, primarily use Google Images for ripping images off the internet to put into presentations and blog posts. And in many cases, not providing sufficient attribution.
Right.
There is some merit to this.
Someone who runs a podcast, for example, might choose as poster images for each show. And then just take them from Google Images as an example.
Not this podcast, obviously, for those who
can't believe
may or may not have copyright on images we may or may not have used.
Don't you blame the Ubuntu podcast, Jonathan Bacon. This is all us.
They are very nice people. It's late night Linux.
Just
shit on our friends.
But they do have a point. The people who are upset about this, that it's way too easy to just do a search, see some images, click view image, and then save as. And I don't necessarily know that I appreciate there is copyright law and you should have to attribute things and so on and so forth, and that's important, and a lot of people don't do it. But you probably at least ought to be poked to think about this more than you currently are, which is not at all. And I think that's the goal here. I mean, I think if Getty got their way, then you wouldn't be able to download any image at all without uploading your certificate of ownership for it or something.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we all agree.
Make it slightly more difficult to get images without even considering who owned them. I think most images out there, it's not actually that big a problem, but occasionally it really hurts someone's livelihood.
Yeah.
Someone takes an image and uses it and it screws that person over, and they're who you're supposed to think of yourself as defending.
Yeah, photographers, for example.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Next news item.
I have another one, unless you want to go first.
No, go.
El Gingo. So this is something that cropped up in the news in the last couple of days, and this is obviously a contentious topic, so I don't think we want to dwell too much on this. So the FreeBSD project, which has been around for many, many years, have updated their code of conduct. And they made a bunch of different changes, and a few different news outlets reported on how virtual hugs have been deemed inappropriate in this code of conduct. Now, this, to be fair, that's cherry picking.
It is.
I want to read a little bit of this because I'm only going to read a couple of paragraphs, so bear with me. But it says, this code of conduct applies to all spaces used by the FreeBSD project, including our mailing lists, IRC channels, blah, 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 blah. Anyone who is found to violate the code of conduct will be sanctioned and expelled from the project at the discretion of the code of conduct committee. Pat Spencer are responsible for following, for knowing and abiding by these rules. Harassment includes but is not limited to comments that reinforce systematic oppression related to gender, gender identity, expression, sexual orientation, disability, mental illness, neurodiversity, physical appearance, body size, age, race, and religion. It talks about unwelcome comments about someone's lifestyle choices and practices, including food, health, parenting, drugs, and employment, deliberate misgendering, deliberate use of dead or rejected names, gratuitous or off-topic sexual images and behavior in spaces where they're not appropriate. It talks about physical contact and simulated physical contact. And this is where it mentions, e.g., textual descriptions like hug or back rub without consent or request to stop, threats of violence. It's kind of a laundry list of different things. Now, you know, there's some of the press has been reporting on the hugs piece, but what was more interesting to me was how detailed this code of conduct is. In a lot of code of conducts that I've been involved in the drafting of, or I've seen, they're somewhat generic, right? They somewhat cover, the big pieces of what we consider to be negative conduct, such as racism and homophobia and things like that. And this goes into a lot of detail. And on one hand, I think this is I think we'd all agree that codes of conduct are absolutely necessary. Sadly, there are lots of people in the world who don't treat other people with dignity and respect, and you need to have a code of conduct as one tool in reinforcing that. But what was interesting to me about this is how granular it gets and whether it's going to accomplish the ultimate goals of that code of conduct, which is to improve the diversity and conduct of people in that community, or whether it's going to create a culture of people being too nervous to speak in, you know, legitimate terms. Like one example here was food or employment or whatever. Now, you know, the dog whistle mentality here could be, well, you can't talk about food anymore in the FreeBSD project. And I don't think that's what the authors of this code of conduct are in any way intending. They clearly want to have people having conversations about this kind of stuff. But it is way more detailed than I've seen before. What do you guys think about it?
I think the detail's a good idea, because as you said, most codes of conduct tend to be high level, you know, we will not accept the following things. And the problem with that is it leads to people essentially pushing the envelope. It doesn't say I can't do that. It leads to arguments about the definition.
Exactly.
It turns
into a legal discussion about the wording.
It derails the whole conversation. And the advantage with having lots of detail is not just that it's down to the people running the project to decide what that means and leave it unstated, but it's also very clear about all this stuff is unacceptable. So if you're thinking, well, no, I won't be homophobic, but you can read this list and go, oh, but I didn't think that was a problem. Oh, it is a problem. Okay, so it's almost a useful guide. It is the definition of what it means to the FreeBSD project to make unwelcome advances to people. And that's really useful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting here to me is the... And I've said this on the show beforehand, like, I think codes of conduct are really important, but in many ways, what's more important, like, a code of conduct sets expectations, but arseholes generally don't read codes of conduct.
Yeah.
What's more important is the way in which any influential people in any company or community influence and run that culture, right? So, like, this is why leaders in a community, it's so important that they maintain the right kind of discipline for what kind of behavior is okay and what's not okay. To your point, Ak, what worries me about this a little bit is because it's so detailed, I think this is going to potentially result in a world of nitpicking where...
So that's what I was going to say, just abstracting it a little bit from this. But so I did see this go by, and I've been so slammed this week, I haven't had time to look into it as much as I would like. But I think... there becomes a point when you're almost too detailed, it has the opposite effect of what you said, Ak, because they'll be like, well, it's not on that very specific list, so I assume I can do it. Where I think what you want, in my opinion, with the code of conduct is to set the cultural expectations for what it is and isn't acceptable for that particular project or company or whatever that code of conduct applies to, be it a conference or whatever. So I think there's a danger in being too detailed where people will just take it as an actual checklist and look for things that aren't on the list, just to be antagonistic.
I see your point. It's like the difference between, say, US and UK law, right?
Yes.
Here, the law is a very kind of slightly hand-wavy, based on precedent, most stuff isn't written down thing. In the US, it's constitution. It's all written down. And yes, then you get people arguing about exactly what interstate commerce is or whatever. Fine, you've got 200 years of precedent to talk about that. But I think most projects do the high-level thing.
Right. Yeah.
Having someone say, you know what, okay, maybe we'll get lots of nitpicking about the exact details of our very detailed list, but we're not going to get lots of nitpicking about what exactly comes under the high-level banners, because we haven't got high-level banners anymore. Mm. Having a project do it a different way is, if nothing else, it's a useful test case. If they do this and find out...
I was just going to say, I think code of conducts are definitely evolving in this...
years.
Code of conducts are definitely evolving as we realize their importance, and trying something new is always a good thing in that regard, I think.
Yeah. That's one thing I'm curious to see here, because it reminds me of back when I worked at Canonical, and where there were incidents, you know, when people would talk about code of conduct violations. It got to what you were saying, like, about that that kind of wordsmithing or nitpicking around the specific wording. And I think, at least from my perspective, that's the wrong way to look at it. Like, there's the spirit of the code of conduct is what we're talking about here. The spirit of what's okay in a community. What worries me a little bit about this, and what we'll see happen and how this pans out, is because it's so detailed, it mentioned in there about this FreeBSD code of conduct committee. I don't quite know how that operates, but I hope that clearly the spirit of this is around inclusive participation from all angles. And this, you know, some members of the press that I've read online have been reading, I think, a little bit too much into this, that, you know, well, the FreeBSD project is no longer a place that accepts this, that, and the other. I don't believe that's going to happen. But I'm curious to see if there's going to be a massive uptick in code of conduct violations and how they will be handled, because it's one thing having a code of conduct, but the maintenance and the enforcement of it is going to be the critical piece. So, yeah. But I just thought it was interesting, and we'll have to watch the space and see what happens.
Yes.
Do we have anything else?
That's the end of the news.
It is. So we're going to go through the whole news segment with no, although we're at a half an hour, I see. No Facebook Protect. That was...
Didn't we touch on that last... Did we touch on that last week?
I haven't looked into it enough to have an opinion. What I've heard is a whole bunch of stuff from other people who've gone...
So why don't we lead the news off the next episode with this, and we can dangle that, I assume, not delicious carrot for 2 weeks.
All right. End of the news.
Last show, we were discussing paying for apps, and Jeremy asked a question, which was, if success on the Linux desktop ends up meaning that we have to move to a paid app ecosystem with a mixture of closed and open source apps, would you prefer that we have that success or stay with what we have now? And we discussed it and said, God, this could be a segment. And this is that segment. So would you prefer that we have that success?
This is either going to be a very short segment or an extremely long segment. I'm not entirely sure.
I have to say, this feels like the sort of Bad Voltage segment where Jono takes one view, Jeremy takes the other view, and I'm kind of in the middle. But let's see. Right. So would you prefer, if we have to move to a paid app ecosystem with a mixture of closed and open source apps, would you prefer that we do that to get success or stay with what we have now?
What do you think, Jeremy?
So I think this is definitely an issue that I have progressed over the years, and my younger self would vehemently disagree with my 2018 self.
This is Jeremy justifying him selling.
So I think previously I would have said no, because I value the freedom that open source brings to the table. I think the pragmatist in me today...
There it comes.
...would say that if we can get a free and open source operating system to be the default choice that respects your privacy much more, is much more secure, is, I think, a better option in general. If the answer is two very closed ecosystems or that, and we have to give a little to get a lot, I'm more willing to give a little to get a lot than I was previously, I think.
Right.
So I would also, to be frank, like some apps because I don't use other systems. So it's a little frustrating that other people can use stuff that I can't because I do choose to still to this day use Linux on my desktop and 100% of the time basis. So I don't have a Windows machine to fall back on if something doesn't run on Linux. So I would sometimes like the new shiny things and continue to be able to use Linux. So I think my concern would be keeping the culture that we have around Linux and around open source. And I don't know if that's possible, but if it was, then it would be, I think, interesting. And, more money in the ecosystem would certainly have, it would be fascinating to watch.
Wow. Ever since you went to work for the man, you've just, dude.
What happened, man? That, to be clear, has what not impacted happened? My opinion at all.
What do you think, Langridge?
Well, this is very depressingly, much as Jeremy says, one of those things where my 24-year-old self would be horrified by most of the answers that I would give these days. It's nice for Jono that he doesn't have that problem because he sold out as early as he possibly could and has stayed committed to being sold out since then.
That is
he full sold
partially
out,
true.
In essence, I do actually feel the same way that Jeremy does. Maybe this is a shorter discussion than we thought it would be, because I would like decent quality apps. I don't often find myself needing an app where that category of things doesn't exist on my desktop. Like Jeremy, I'm 100% Linux. Full-time Linux on desktop, don't have Windows machines to fall back on, whatever. It's rare that I reach for a particular app and nothing like it exists on our desktop. That used to be the case 15, 20 years ago. There was a whole bunch of stuff where you just didn't have any. There was nothing. And that's very rarely the case now. What I do miss is the quality of applications. And I don't necessarily think that's related to being closed source or open source, but I absolutely think it's relevant. It's related to being paid or unpaid. Because if you are insistent on relying on apps which you can get for free and which everyone does get for free, then they can only be built pretty much as a spare time project. People have been talking for 30 years about ways to fund open source which aren't about people give you money and get a copy of the software. And a lot of those answers do work if you're building something to be deployed in the cloud or you're selling subscriptions or something like that. But they don't work if what I want to buy is a really good, simple photo editor for the Linux desktop. There is no other model other than you give me £2 for the app or you give me 20.
Do you think there is no other model, or do you think there is no other model that we've found yet?
It's possible there is no other model that we've found yet, but equally we've been searching for a hell of a long time and nothing's come up. I'm prepared to go, let's stop the search at this point, because we've tilted it enough windmills now that surely one of them would have been the thing. I would like to see the move to a paid app ecosystem. I'm not particularly pushing for it to be a closed app ecosystem. It's not clear to me whether if you build open source apps and say, well, we would like you to pay, whether most people will go, no, because I can get it myself and steal it. Not steal it, but, I can get it myself because I'm allowed and I won't pay. Or whether people will go, no, screw it, I'll just pay because whatever. There are examples on both sides of that equation, right? Yeah. And I don't know which way to fight, but that's why I think things like the elementary payment stuff is a really good idea, because it's trying to incentivize people to pay for something which they don't necessarily have to in order to get it. There's a game, I can't think of the name of it. It was mentioned to me by McPhail. It's in Steam. It's an open source game, but it's on Steam for Windows and Linux and a bunch of other things. And it's a tenner or something. And they've sold thousands and thousands and thousands of copies. And someone could just download it and play it without going through Steam, but people pay it. And I don't think, Jono said last time in the last show that most of the people who are paying for elementary things are doing so out of a sense of duty and desire to support the project. But I do not believe that is the case, people buying games off of Steam. So this model can work. People will pay because they don't know any better or because they want the convenience or whatever. They're not doing it out of a sense of support. So I think a paid app ecosystem could work, and I think it's much more likely that we get things like vector editors or video editors or things like that, where you've got a bunch of things, none of which are anything like as good as the proprietary competition. I think if people were paying 15 quid for each copy of those, but it was open sourced, it wouldn't matter. We'd get something great because people could work on it full time. And that's what I'd like to see.
The tricky thing here, I think, so I think there's a few data points, you know, and then there's our views, of course. Like, I mean, I think it's undeniable, and I know this is probably an unpopular viewpoint with some in the open source world, but I think the vast majority of open source that's being produced today is being produced because of a commercial reason, right? Like, if you look at all the work that's happening in the cloud and other areas, it's because companies are trying to reduce the costs of deploying software or deploying services and whatever else. You know, these companies are not necessarily producing this open source technology just because they want to build something that's of value to the community. What they want to do is they want to build something so they can improve the efficiency or reduce the cost of which they're running their businesses.
Yeah. I think on the infrastructure side, it's absolutely commercial driven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the desktop app side, less so.
And sadly, I would say that, yes, there are cases where people do pay for free things, for free open source things, for things that they can get in an otherwise free way without any kind of scarcity component. But I think they're edge cases. I don't think they are the norm. And part of the reason why I think we're in this predicament is because I think, you know, I find this a difficult topic to discuss because there is like an ideological component to this. Like, we want the elementary guys to succeed, right? There's no question about that. Like, they're working hard and they're producing something that, you know, they want to build an ecosystem that combines the right approach to software freedom and provides food on the table for the people who are building software. I just don't think it's going to work. I think the ideological side of me wants it to work, but I see no data to suggest why it will work. Because
bear with me. This is going to sound like a complaint, and it isn't, but it feels like you're kind of doing an end run around the question, right? Jeremy's question was, if success means we have to move to a paid app ecosystem with a mixture of closed open source apps, would you prefer we had that success or stay with what we have now?
Right.
But your argument seems to be there's no point in answering that question because your proposed paid app ecosystem with a mixture of closed open source apps isn't going to work.
Well, I think there are two components to this. One is, so the elementary model, which I think we would, again, from an ideological perspective, I think we would say is the perfect balance of respecting software freedom and providing an economic model, right? As best we can say. I think that from a freedom perspective, it's a brilliant thing, and I applaud the elementary guys for it. From a financial perspective, I don't think it's going to work, despite the best will in the world. Now, the second question there is, to Jeremy's point, like having an open source operating system and then having, you know, paid apps or non-free apps such as Skype or whatever else, or games and Steam and stuff like that, and there, is that considered success? In my mind, I don't subscribe to the viewpoint that absolutely everything needs to be open source and everything needs to be free. I think operating systems are there to serve that they're general purpose pieces of software that enable people to do lots of different things. And I don't believe you'll ever have open source that will serve all of those things. We already see that today, right? There's, you know, most people producing software are using proprietary software. Most people who are doing videos are using proprietary software. There are open source alternatives available, but they're not in general use, right? They're niche use. And they're very good at what they do, but they're in niche use. They haven't captured the market. So to me, like having...
Yes, I mean, a couple of exceptions, but yes.
I think having an open source core, to Jeremy's points about, like, you know, an operating system that respects your freedom and your privacy and stuff like that, I think that as a baseline is really important. Like, I would love to be in a position that... I mean, I use a Mac most of the time now. And the reason why is because the software I need to run doesn't run on Linux, by and large. And you know, I wish it wasn't the case. I would way prefer to be used in Linux. But, you know, it's a cost-benefit decision. And so I think if we had a situation where an open source operating system where you're running things on top of it that aren't necessarily completely free or completely open source, to me, that's totally fine. And I think we've broadly had that view, all three of us, at least for the last 4 or 5 years. I know earlier, Ack, you used to be much more along the Free Software Foundation lines, but I know you've sold out almost as quickly as Jeremy has. So
I was going to say, Ack, you used to be by far furthest to the left, I think. Jono, a long time ago, sold out to the extent that he didn't even get change. He's just... he's past his return period, and it's his.
But sold out, an ancient African word meaning embracing reality.
The thing is, 10 years ago, there was much. I made so many sacrifices in my mind to use Linux 10 years ago. Every time I bought something, it didn't work. Or, you know, if I got a Trio back then, the software didn't work, and I had to do all kinds of weird things to get around that.
Yeah.
Where I don't feel like I make those kinds of... do I have to not use Linux decisions with the regularity that I used to? But it still comes up from time to time. And I'm curious to see, as the world seems to be moving to the cloud and what now Photoshop and those kinds of things, that was always the benchmark for whatever arbitrary reason was, will Photoshop run on Linux? Now the Photoshop, much of it runs in a browser. I'm curious to see if Linux will get more popular with any OEMs, because those kinds of, most things now do run in a browser. And for the average computer user, I think Jono is not a great example of the average computer user, because he's a content creator in a way that he requires specific tools that he wants. And if those specific tools don't run an operating system, he's not going to change the entire workflow that he's learned over the last decade to use something differently. And I think content creators are very picky about their tools, as they should be, right? I mean, any artist, any craftsman is particular about his tools. But I think for the average computer user, where... 10 years ago, Office was necessary. And by that, I don't mean an Office suite. I mean Microsoft Office. I think by and large today, the average user could use, be it Office 365 or LibreOffice, is, I think, compatible to a level for the non-Office user is fine. I think now the average user probably could get away with using Linux. And I am curious to see if one large OEM kind of breaks from the past and tries to sell a commercial Linux desktop.
What's tricky about this is, I agree with you, particularly with everything moving so much to the web. You know, you can get web browsers in Linux. Check it out. Right.
And it's not even just web browsers, it's just Chrome and Firefox, which are the same. I mean, I guess a few people might use Edge, but predominantly, regardless of your OS, it's going to be Firefox and Chrome.
But when I said earlier that there are, when you were saying, you know, the market leaders in almost every field aren't open source, and I agreed with you and said, but there are exceptions. Browsers are the primary thing I was thinking of. Chrome and Firefox, both open. Well, Chrome isn't technically.
Not even technically, though. I don't get why Chrome's not open source, and that's not a bad thing per se, but Chromium's open source. No one uses Chromium.
I'm using Chromium, and I've never noticed the difference. Yes, people are using Chrome, but if they were using Chromium instead, I don't think anyone would notice.
The only people who are using Chromium are Linux users.
Yes, no, I agree with you. Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that they are using Chromium, but if the Chrome people uploaded Chromium.exe instead of Chrome.exe in the next release and it automatically updated to it, nobody would know.
Right. Yeah. But the one thing I was going to say was...
The bits that make Chrome proprietary and Chromium not are not important, in my opinion.
The thing I was going to say was, you know, given, based on Jeremy's point, given the fact that so much of stuff is moving over to the web or has moved over to the web, I spend the vast majority of my day in a web browser. The bits and pieces that I use on my computer that don't work in a web browser, you know, some of those things are supported in Linux, but they're kind of like shonky knockoffs in some cases. It then begs the question, like, what is the value of Linux as an operating system? Like, at that point, like, if for somebody to move away from, like, I think part of the reason why so many people move from Windows to Macs, like, what, 8-10 years ago, was because Windows was becoming so unreliable and so bad in terms of things like, you know, viruses and security and all that kind of stuff. And it was becoming so cluttered and slow that people liked the efficiency of a Mac. But I'm curious to see what would move people from Windows 10, which is actually not bad, and Mac OS X, which is has been pretty consistently okay, to an Ubuntu or to a Fedora or to something else. What would the reasons be? It used to be always viruses and security, but to be fair, Mac and Windows have pretty much upped their game now, where it's reasonably decent for most consumers, I would say.
I think the realization that I came to, which my 24-year-old self hadn't realized, is that if there's a thing that I can't do on my desktop, there's a fundamental distinction in my head between I can't do this because no one's made it possible yet, and I can't do it because no one's allowed to make it possible. If you could have this thing, but you are being prevented from having it, I find that really, 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 really annoying. One of the big reasons I use Linux on my desktop is because that can't happen. If I could have this thing, but nobody's built it yet, I just kind of shrug my shoulders and go, oh, well, it would be good if I had the world's best 3D modeler, but nobody's ported Maya or 3D Studio Max or whatever to Linux. But they could do tomorrow, and then I'd have it. Whereas, I mean, this is much more of a problem for phones than it is for desktops, right? But the thing that I butt up against with iOS is stuff where it would be perfectly possible, it's just banned by fiat rather than because no one's built it yet. And because I personally find that extremely frustrating, the fact that I use Linux on my desktop is a nice safety net against that, because that basically doesn't
happen. What do you mean by banned by fiat?
Apple says you can't do it, so you can't do it regardless of if they do it and it's possible. Yeah.
But that's in the App Store.
What do you mean that's in the App Store? You can't get apps anywhere any other way on iOS.
We're talking about desktops. I'm not talking about iOS.
He was comparing it to mobile.
I said this is more of a problem on phones than it is on desktops. I totally agree with you
on the phone side. But you know, on a desktop, I mean, I don't, on my Mac, I get barely, pretty much nothing from the app from the Mac Store. It's useless.
If you look at things like Gatekeeper, right, where apps have to be signed, they were certainly talking a couple of years ago about how wouldn't let you run apps that weren't signed. Now, they backed down from that, and it's not clear whether it was ever actually a thing. But I'm pretty confident that no one can do that to my desktop, so I don't have to think about it. Again, I'm not suggesting this is a reason why anyone else would move. I'm just explaining why I do it. Right?
But it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, well, Apple could enforce this policy that I don't like with all of these apps on the Mac, but I don't have that issue on the Linux because those apps aren't available.
Correct. Yes. And that's exactly what I'm saying. And that distinction in my head is important.
It's ludicrous. No, I get what you're saying. I mean, look, I think it's undeniable that one of the great values of Linux, right, is you're in control of your own destiny, right? But then I would argue that that's true to a degree, but you're getting your Linux primarily from, unless you're using Debian, you know, if you're using Ubuntu, you're getting your Linux from an organization, and there's resourcing constraints. I mean, I think Canonical and Red Hat have been pretty decent in terms of making sure that they respect people's freedoms and privacy and stuff like that. But there's also, like, there's limitations on what you can get in Linux, right? So...
Yeah, no, absolutely. As I say, this distinction is fairly peculiar to me. I'm not for a moment suggesting that this would motivate other people to move. I'm just telling you how I feel about it.
So it sounds like the three of us all think that it's okay to have an open source operating system. Like, we think that that's really important, but it's okay to have non-free or paid-for apps that run on top of it, and we'd consider that to be success. So that's largely the state of the desktop today, right? Is that people are running Spotify and Skype and whatever else on their Linux desktops.
We agree on this on a higher degree than I anticipated we would, if I'm being honest.
I mean, I largely think that the open sourceness of the apps is, to a large extent, irrelevant. I mean, do you think that if Microsoft just published the source code of Word to GitHub tomorrow, that it would materially affect their business. Ignore for the moment the fact that anyone else could download it and then sell Jeremy Word for half as much money, right? Pretend you can't do that. That's a really big, important point, but leave it to one side.
Never name any software product with the word Jeremy in it. That's just ridiculous.
Jeremy Pendle would disagree with you. But no, so even including that, I don't think many people would buy that product who are currently buying Word.
Right, exactly. So that's the point. It would not, I don't think it would materially harm Word's business model if it just happened. The fact that it, whether it's open source or closed source is basically irrelevant. And that's what I think. Where if, I think paying for stuff, having a paid app ecosystem is important to circle back around to the original question, precisely because then there'd be more money in the ecosystem. So we'd get better apps because people can work on it instead of their job rather than working on it as well as their job.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is here is I think the sticking point, like, you know, what triggered this whole thing in the previous show was the elementary paid app store thing. And I think one of the downsides here that's going to challenge their model is there's just not enough people using Linux on the desktop, right? So you need to have a lot of people paying to bring in enough money to cover that. Like, just to give you an example, there's a guy called Steve... God, I've forgotten his last name. I want to say Steve Harris, but that's the bassist Nine Maiden. I haven't talked to him for years. And you know, and he basically works on the Ada multi-track audio editor,
which is really good software.
And it's great software. He's been working on it for years.
He's called Paul something, isn't he?
Oh, Paul!
I thought it was Paul as well. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right. No, where I'm getting confused is there is a guy called Steve Harris who makes a bunch of LADSPA plugins.
Right, yes. Yeah.
So Paul someone, I can forget. I think it's Paul
Robinson.
Harris.
You keep talking, I'm going to look it up.
Paul Robinson was in Neighbours.
Oh, yeah.
So, Australian soap opera. But anyway...
Paul Davis,
that's it. Davis Harris, very similar. Anyway, you know, and he brings in not a significant salary, but he gets to work on the thing that he loves doing, and it covers him, but it covers him specifically. And then he's really good at stewarding the community. Mm-hmm. But again, these are kind of edge cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is changing the norm, changing the culture. At that point, things like Yorba can set up and will make enough money to fund their developers, which they couldn't do before. And so on. There should be thousands of little companies who do one piece of software and make enough money to survive at it. What I don't know is whether the culture is changeable at this point or whether that ship has already sailed.
So
Jeremy's question was posed in a kind of if that
this brings
changed,
up an interesting point
it?
Though I think there used to be a bunch of small software shops, for example for the Mac, making really cool one or two apps and employing three people. I don't see that existing as much on the Mac side these days either.
No. I think it does. I think I hang out a lot with Mac people because web guy, right? And a lot of the software that you look at things like Pixelmator or that sort of thing. When people are seeking out tools, OmniGraffle, so on and so forth, when they're seeking out tools, obviously the kind of the known standard is the stuff that comes from Apple, the stuff that comes from Adobe, so on and so forth. But people are still using bits of software that come from a software shop who do that bit of software or half a dozen bits of software and that's it, Panic and people like that. And those things seem to be sustainable businesses. As far as I'm aware, there's hardly anyone doing that on the Linux desktop. Gaming places, maybe, but certainly not desktop software.
Well, I want the Linux equivalent to like Rogue Amoeba.
Yeah, I would very much like that kind of software to exist. What I don't know is whether it ever will, because anyone who's doing that now is building that software on the web instead, because then they're open to everybody and can still charge 20 quid.
Right, exactly. It's too low of a target audience.
At which point,
an audience that can take your product for free. Like, it's a business model that doesn't make any sense, sadly. I mean...
Yeah, so I think...
And history has taught us that. I'd love there to be... I mean, who knows? We see new business models spring up all the time. Maybe there will be something new in the future. I mean, the future is a big place, right? So
would we summarize our answer collectively to Jeremy's original question is, yes, we'd prefer to make that move. We just don't think it can happen.
I think, sadly, that's the case.
I think
that's
it
my
can.
View.
Ah! Jeremy thinks it can.
Sounds like a future segment.
Is this the Jeremy panel segment? Is this Jeremy's major new business?
It's not, but
it's like he's leaving the man to form a new business.
I don't know when it will happen, and it's certainly not going to be now, but I would like to think with the amount of quality software engineers writing open source that we can figure out the business side of the equation to enable more open source software to be written, used, and make the entire ecosystem sustainable, I believe.
Interesting.
I like that, Faith, but what you appear to be missing out the bit on the other sentence where you say, I've got no idea how we do it, but surely something will turn up. That's a bit more fatalist than I'm prepared to be about this kind of thing.
Yeah. Jeremy, you're not usually the idealist in these discussions.
I don't think
refreshing.
It's. I don't necessarily think it's an idealistic point of view.
I
agree. I agree that the countless examples where this has failed in the past. Yeah. It's been, okay. All right.
Well, then I get to be the idealist for one time ever.
Yeah, you can. It's like your one like on the forum.
Exactly.
There it is. So I don't think it's idealism, said the idealist, as much like I don't think this is cynicism, said the cynic.
Right. Yeah, how dare you dream, Gus, here?
I'll be interested to hear what other people think about this, specifically whether they can fill in the last jigsaw piece in Jeremy's idealism and explain how to actually do it.
Go to the forum or go to the Slack channel, share your thoughts. Love to hear some ideas around how we could make this work. So, end of the show. There we have it.
There it was. Thank you very much.
Yep. I really have nothing else to... Actually, Jeremy, how was Fosdem?
Good. Very good. Yep. I had never been, and it is a little bit of madness, I will say. The cafeteria and the food lines... really underscore it's difficult to get a concept for how many people are there because it's so spread out. So for those of you who have never been to Fosdem, it's on a college campus and it's in many different buildings, so it's very spread out. But then you go to the cafeteria and it is insanity.
Yeah.
I think it went really well. It was a really engaging crowd. It was fun.
I haven't been for years, and when I went, it was a bit raggedy around the edges, but that kind of has its own charm, you know.
So I had heard that from many people, and I was actually talking with Wally about that while we were there, and neither of us really got that impression. I don't know if it's just evolved a little bit over the years, or maybe just the rooms that we went in were, for whatever reason, a little bit different. But
are you suggesting that maybe they have improved in the last 12 years? Madness. So
I think you can be grassroots without being raggedy.
That's another segment, isn't it?
It is, right. Actually. Before we go, are either of you speaking anywhere in the next couple of weeks? I'm not.
Yes, I'll be speaking at Scale in Pasadena. I know Jeremy's going to be out there, and at the Open Source Leadership Summit in Sonoma, which Jeremy's going to be there as well.
Yep, so. I will be at both of those and speaking at Scale as well. I don't think that's before the next show, but yep. In the next month, right. Certainly.
Actually, yeah. I think one of our recordings actually is at the same time as one of these things. I can't remember. But anyway, I'll check. But, yep. We'll see what happens. So, how about... But nothing for you, Langridge? You haven't got anything going on?
No. All rather quiet. So, thank you very much.
All right. Laters. Skaters.